Session number 1, 2, 3, 8, 5, rule 17.
Williamson, reel 17.
Yes. Then he said, comrades, surely someone must have some disagreement with what I've said. It is the duty of comrades everywhere, communists everywhere, have a duty, even if it's, what they feel, they should expose anything that they hear or see if they think it's wrong. And they said, now there must be someone with some disagreement, and perhaps there were a couple of people just wanted elucidating on a couple of facts, but no disagreement whatsoever. And then he says, ah, who do we see at the far end of the hall but a visiting comrade from the MacPaps? Welcome, comrade, to our meeting. And what do you think? Of the meeting so far, and what are your views on it? And I said, well, you see, it's not the place of someone that's been invited in as a guest into someone else's house to criticize them. It is not my position, it's not my intention, and it would be different if it was with the MacPaps or even with the Lincolns, I said, but no way am I going to involve your hospitality by inviting me here, by retaliating in any way whatsoever. The comrade, he says, comrade, you have heard what I said. It is not only your right, but your duty to say what you say. And then I said, well, you asked for it, and I said, you're going to get it. If you want to know, I've never heard such fucking awful bullshit in all my life. And I said, if you took me out of this door right now and threatened to shoot me for what I'm going to say, I would not retract a word of it. I was just proving that you're not much better than the fascists themselves. And then I was far more voluble in those days, and I could remember things better, and I just ripped out most of his speech and just tore it to pieces with a lot of obscene languages. And I've got a feeling that although we use very obscene language in the MacPaps and the Lincolns, I've got a feeling most of the English battalion, they were ordinary working guys, and they would use bloody and occasionally fuck and so on, but as a whole, they didn't use so much bad language, so I must have startled them. And then you could feel after he'd finished, there was a complete silence for at least a minute, so much so that I was getting uncomfortable. Then he said, after he'd gasped for breath, well, we do applaud you, Comrade Williamson, for your honesty and so on and so forth there. And then Jeff Meyerwater came round just when I was leaving in the dark. Said, I think you fouled up the chance of joining our group. But anyway, that was just one point. And then towards the middle of October, the MacPaps went into action for the first time as a separate battalion at Fuentes de Ebro.
Before we discuss that, right, yes. I just want to ask a couple more questions. did you discuss with Leo Mendelowitz, sorry.
Yes.
And the other MacPaps, why they were there, why they were in Spain? I know it seems obvious to you, but did you ever discuss this sort of thing?
With what?
Did you ever discuss with Leo?
Yes.
Why he had come to Spain?
Oh, he came to Spain because he was a Jew. Two, he was a communist. Three, his elder brother had been killed in Spain 6 months previously. And it was just part of the anti-fascist struggle.
Well, how did his Jewishness fit in with this?
Well, it shows you have not a complete understanding of the times at that
time. No, I do. I know exactly what you mean. I want you to tell me. I want you to tell me. I know. I understand.
Oh, yes.
I'm not interested in
that. That would be quite a natural question for anyone to ask at this time. But at that time, the only party worldwide that was acting as a bastion against the fascist aggression worldwide was the Communist Party. So that could you,
Bill? We won't talk about the. You explained to me why Leo went. Could you just remember some of the things that you used to talk about when you were in the Olive Groves and when you were resting?
Yes,
and Leo and the other chaps.
I think most we talked about those who'd been in mostly about the political fights of the past and what we'd got to do in the future to make a better place to live in, and what we intended to do if we got through the war and got back, and also about, different jobs that we'd had. They'd reminisce about their jobs or their teachers or their girlfriends, and it wasn't only just discussing the politics and so on. We would just in general topics, I think, like anything else, just refer to that. But of course, the political scene would be dominant all the time.
And what were you called at this time? Well, they had a nickname for you. What was your nickname?
Oh, yes. In the MacPap especially, I think it was Leo Mendelowitz who first called me the Bilbao Disaster or something like that. But I don't know whether he's holding me responsible for the collapse of the North or not. But most everyone had a nickname of one kind or another in Spain. That it would be Big George Poole or something, or Little Leo or something. That anyway,
you were telling me about the Fuentes de Ebro. You're about to come down to the Fuentes.
Pardon?
You're about to talk about the Fuentes de Ebro when we had this aside.
About the what?
The Fuentes de Ebro.
Oh, yes, Fuentes de Ebro, yes. Well, I think I should mention there, before we get to Fuentes de Ebro, a long time before that, was the first battle. Oh yes, at Fuentes de Ebro. No, I'm sorry. Can you just... Yes, the first battle that the MacPaps took part in was Fuentes de Ebro, and it was very well conceived. The broad strategy of the attack on Fuentes de Ebro was quite correct, but the tactics on the ground went wildly awry. The idea was to capture the city. One of the grand strategy of the attack on Fuentes de Ebro, capture in the big city of Saragossa, or Zaragoza in Spanish, which was a big industrial city of Catalonia, and what went wrong, first of all, is that I think the high command had seen too many movies documentary movies of the Russian Red Army exercises. Especially, they had a very, very famous one, which I saw myself in Spain, called Red Army Exercise in 1936. In the fall of 1936. So, incidentally, this was the, in this documentary, was the first showing of mass landing of parachute troops anywhere in the world. And I remember these huge lumbering six-engined Soviet bombers with Soviet flyers, Soviet parachutists climbing out all along the wings and dropping off there, and also dropping light fuel guns and everything by parachute and so on. But above all, a thing that struck me at that time was a great show of the Red Army advancing on with a whole battalion put on the back of tanks. And this is some guy in the high command had seen this thing and thought it was appropriate to Fuentes de Ebro, whereas it might have been quite okay on the flat plains of the Ukraine. But it was completely unsuitable for the terrain we were attacking over. And we were, first of all, everything sort of started to go wrong. We moved up to the front of Fuentes de Ebro, and the transport was delayed, and so that... eventually, when it did come, when we were deployed from the transport, from the trucks that were taking us up to the front line, it was already growing light when the and we were under heavy 75mm and 85 and 88mm shell fire when we got out. And our job was to replace some Spanish battalion that had already been some weeks in the trenches, and the trenches were only hardly more than a foot deep in places, and we had to detrain from the trucks and get along to these and make a dash for the nearest of these trenches and then crawl along on our bellies anyone who put his head above the 1 foot of ground that was sheltering you got his head blown off. And we suffered some losses getting into positions before we could get into the deeper trenches later on there. The Mac Paps, we got our machines guns set up and got a crossfire on the first fascist trenches there. And then we had the order to move forward again. And again, we suffered very, very heavy losses moving forward. But we did take the Franco trenches. And then we got on there. And I remember it was a cloudless sky. I think it was about the middle of October. But a beautiful, hot, warm day that, we got into these trenches, and at least we were guaranteed some respite before we went on to attack the town itself. But apparently, I don't know where our knowledge fell down, the general headquarters knowledge, but the our mass of tanks that we did have, some couple of hundred tanks, I suppose, were another thing is everything was supposed to be coordinated. First of all, we got put back by the trucks arriving late and in our positions, and then there was this huge attack for us, a huge attack, but by the by our tanks and infantry, and also by the Air Force, a combined offensive. First of all, the Air Force came over way too early and bombed hell out of the fascists. And then we were in trenches, and then we were amazed to see hear the roar of our tanks coming up from the rear. It might have made an impressive movie scene. What we saw was the tanks of the, I think it was the 24th Battalion, hanging on to the backs of these tanks, swarming with people, with soldiers and so on. And charging at about 30 miles an hour over the terrain. And we were in the row of trenches just vacated by the fascists. And I had at that time a Leica camera. And I sort of, once I have a camera in my hands, I sort of forget all sorts of fear and so on there. And I was shooting away because I had a unique position, I would say, of the tanks coming forward, and not only coming forward towards us. And I remember Leo Mandela was saying, "Oh, shit, the bastards are shooting at us." And in fact, they were the tanks. Thought we were the first line of fascist trenches, and they're blowing shit out of the trenches and coming forward all the time. I got shot after shot of the first wave of tanks going over, and not only that, but seeing it was a Leica, I could, as fast as I could roll on to the next picture I was shooting, some of the tanks going straight over our heads as they went over and towards the real fascist lines, so that and then I had just time to put another roll of film in and get a shot of the second wave coming over, and it was a truly inspiring sight, but many were swept off by machine gun fire and so on. And then they got into this, again, they got into a deep arroyo just beyond our trenches. And something they hadn't bargained for, the tanks couldn't climb out of the thing that 50% or more of them were disabled and blown up the tanks. And I think the only Canadian tank commander was, I've forgotten his name, his tank was destroyed, but he managed to get out and get a hitch on one of the other tanks going back. But the whole thing was a fiasco. We lost a terrific number of lives. And for the sake of gaining about a couple of or less than 2 kilometres of ground. And then perhaps another sort of aside from the thing, when we'd lost so many men at this time that they hadn't got anyone to send from officers' training school, and they just scouted around amongst the our folk there, and they just picked on Leo Mendelowitz and said, well, you're going to be the company commander with the rank of captain of, in spite of him being one of the chief beefers. And so that he was made captain then. And I suppose...
How did he react to that?
Oh, I thought, you know, he's one captain that you... could have complete faith in.
Was he pleased?
Well, I don't think. I think he would have probably. Yes, I think he was pleased as a recognition of his worth, but he was neither displeased or pleased that was his. It was given to him, and he'd carry out the job. But there wouldn't be any bullshit or anything with the rest of, like the rest of the people wanting to organise separate canteens for the officers and men. And then I suppose yes, we were occupying these front trenches for about a couple of weeks, I suppose, going on patrols and probing the enemy positions.
What was the enemy positions like at this time?
They would be trenches just the same as ourselves.
How far away from you were they?
Oh, the trenches would vary in places from 50 metres to 150 metres, I suppose. That perhaps 200 metres. The length of this road that...
Away from you, yeah.
Yes, and other places closer, perhaps as short as 50, 75 metres away. But mostly... about the nearest it was with a close sprint, with one of the sprints in the Olympic Games, but our job was to go out in the daytime. We could see what was going on, but at night time we sent out patrols, and although it was sort of unheard of. Leo came with me on one of the patrols there. That and then I don't know where it came from or something. A couple of bursts of rifle fire or machine gun fire. I can't recall now which it was. And then I was hit in the arm, and a terrific pain in the right arm. I had been wounded previously in the north, but that was in the other arm. So Leo Mendelowitz got me back to our line of trenches and got the paramedics and Leo Mendelowitz staunched the flow of blood from my arm there, but the pain was excruciating, whereas in the previous wound I didn't remember it paining till later, but this time was terrific, going right to reaching the whole of your body and so on. So Leo said, well, we've got to get you back sometime. So he gave the orders to I think a sergeant or something. And of course, Leo was in every night. We had I had always made it made it a law unto myself that I never took liquor before going into battle, because it slowed your wits up a bit, but I always took of it to keep out the cold or anything. So Leo had these two liter bottles, or I think maybe the one liter bottle. I can't recall the size of them now, but anyway, he said that perhaps this will help deaden the pain. So he gave me a couple of shots and had one himself, and then still didn't have any action. And I think for some reason away, the nearest hospital was several miles away anyway, in the rear. I don't know why it was so far away, but possibly because of the bombing and so on that we'd suffered. And so that it was, he said, well, we've got to get you there. And I got this damned thing that was shrieking with pain almost, that almost unbearable. I discovered afterwards, because they'd cut the nerves. That, so Leo said, anyway, mentioned to his sergeant there that he's taking me back. And I remember we were sort of, I was quite jolly by this time, still had the pain, and he still, these bottles were for the whole company, a whole machine gun company, for the night. But he said, well, I guess they can go without it for the night. And it's real raw cognac. It's not the sort of thing you buy in the shops there. It was sort of 100% proof. So every so often he'd...
Yes, you were just describing the, he was giving you drinks.
Oh, yes.
On the way.
Well, it still didn't have very great effect on the pain, so I had more and more swigs out of this bottle there, and Leo also had one or two drinks, but not as much as me. But anyway, I couldn't rightly say how far we walked, but all I remember, it was a sort of heathland of heather and rocky ground and that sort of thing. We stumbled along over all sorts of tracks, but it was again a full moon that and I remember looking up, and I was unconscious of everything else but looking up and looking at the sky and seeing the clouds scudding across this full moon there that and just stumbling along, aided by Leo. And eventually we reached the place all right, and then I flaked out completely. I can't remember what happened after that. And and then perhaps 2 days later, when the doctor came around,